Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, in for Jane Lindholm. According to the Alzheimer's Association Vermont chapter, around 13,000 people in the state are living with Alzheimer's. The organization also estimates that over 30,000 family and friends are providing care. Today, our program focuses on those caregivers. Later this hour, we'll hear from Dr. Michael Lamantia, a geriatrician and director of the Center on Aging at UVM. He'll discuss the importance of caring for caregivers. But we'll start today by listening back to a Vermont Edition episode when we heard the stories of two Vermonters who provided care for loved ones with Alzheimer's.
Caring for a loved one with memory loss, whether it's Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia or brain injury, can be scary, draining, frustrating, tedious. It can also be full of funny and fun moments, tender love and care, and a sense of purpose. In September of 2015, Sheila Dooley of Fairfax joined us to tell us about her husband, Jim. He had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease 2 years earlier.
Well, for us, we're probably a little different than most families because my husband's mother had Alzheimer's. And he entered into a research study with Johns Hopkins in 2000 with his sister. And every 3 years, he and his sister would go to Johns Hopkins and be tested. And it was in 2013 that he went to be tested and he failed. And I knew he was going to fail because before that, he was struggling. He was struggling with appointments. He was struggling with a computer. He was getting anxious and frustrated very easily. So when I got the diagnosis from Johns Hopkins and they said, you need to go home and speak to go to a neurologist, I knew that that was coming. And when we did get the final diagnosis, it made sense for him, even though he was angry. It gave him a reason as to why he was doing what was happening to him.
That was Sheila Dooley on Vermont Edition just about 2 years ago, explaining how the family learned about her husband Jim's diagnosis of Alzheimer's. Sheila is back with us today to discuss the role of caregivers and the challenges that it entails to be a caregiver. Jim died earlier this year, and Sheila, I'm very sorry for your loss, and I'm really grateful to you for being here today.
Thank you very much.
So you are listening back now to 2 years, and even then you were talking back 2 years. You told me just before the show things have really changed in your perspective. I mean, obviously a lot has happened in the last 2 years, but even your perspective has changed?
My perspective has changed because I found that it is very difficult to be a caregiver 24/7 for somebody with Alzheimer's. You start out with good intentions, but as the time goes on, you find that it gets more and more difficult because you find that they are changing very quickly. Some of them are. And when that happens, you try to keep up with them, but you can't always.
And what do you mean when you say you try to keep up with them? What did that mean for you and Jim trying to keep up with him?
Well, he was failing very fast. And one of the things that was happening is he was losing his verbiage. And he would get very frustrated. So some of the times when he'd get really frustrated, I would just hold his hand and I would say, you're safe. I'm here to take care of you. Everything's going to be okay. And he would calm down. But sometimes he would get very angry. And one of the things that I found that helped me is I got into counseling, and I suggest it because it helps to smooth things out when you're listening to somebody yell, cry, or be angry at you all the time, sometimes all the time. It starts to wear on your mental status, and you start to question, am I doing anything wrong? And when in fact it's just the Alzheimer's talking. And you have to remember that you're a human being and that you too have emotional needs and you need to take care of them.
It sounds like you managed to see that, not waiting till the end to say, oh my gosh, I am just losing myself here, but you realized at some point, I have to get some help with this.
I did. And I got my help through the Veterans Center here in Burlington. They were wonderful. And they actually came out to our house also to counsel Jim. So we were fortunate to have that availability to us. And I suggest if it's available and you can do it, you should.
You know, you said Jim's personality changed and he would get very frustrated. I mean, obviously, when you're going through these, you know, you hear from people, my grandmother too, you know, you sometimes know what's happening to you and that's frustrating. And then sometimes you don't quite understand what's happening to you if you're a person who has Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. And it can be really scary and overwhelming to be in a world that doesn't make sense to you. So you can understand why there are those personality changes. But for you, as Jim's wife, that must be so hard. This person who you've loved and lived with is not the same person, and you're still trying to take care of them through all of these changes and through what, as you pointed out, can really be anger that's directed at the caregiver. How did you deal with that?
I dealt with it by saying, this is not Jim when he got angry, or this is not Jim when he was frustrated. Because when he had his lucid moments, and it was out, he would have them every day, he would say to me, did I tell you I love you? And when he was clear, he would say to me that he wanted me to know how much he loved me and that he didn't want to forget. He didn't want to forget me. He didn't want to forget that he loved me. So those helped. That helped a lot. And I would also talk. Jim and I talked. And I would ask him sometimes, what did it feel like when you're in these moments? And he would say to me that it was like everything was spinning chaotically out of control. And that he didn't know how to stop it. And he was scared. He said, I am so frightened. So that, again, is when I would just hold his hand and say, everything's okay, you're safe. And we would constantly have this communication. And one of the things, too, that helped with Jim is I created a memory book. And in the memory book, I would take pictures. I made a big memory book. And I would take pictures. And what you want to do in a memory book is you have the picture and you do it in big text underneath. Short sentences, such as I would say, first person, me and my dog Gus walking on the recreation path, or me and my wife Sheila sitting on the bench, so that they know that it is them in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helped. He carried that book with him until the very end and showed everybody he could his memory book. So those are little tidbits that help. But it is very hard emotionally losing your loved one, whether it's a spouse or a parent, to see them slip away.
Oh, yeah. I can only imagine. And I really appreciate you being willing to talk about this today. Listeners, we are talking about what it's like to be somebody who's caring for somebody you love who has Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, memory loss. You know, there are ways that are similar for anybody who's caring for a loved one who's in a health condition that's deteriorating. But there are some specific things that relate to memory loss and dementia, things like personality changes and struggles to figure out what era you're living in that are fairly common. And as more Vermonters age and more of us experience some perspective on this, we thought it would be a good time to talk to a couple of Vermonters today about what it's been like for them. Now, over the last many months, we've occasionally gotten emails and calls from a listener named Rob in Burlington. He's often advocated for more research and funding and focus on Alzheimer's disease. And we reached out to Rob to be part of today's discussion as we talk about what it's like to care for someone with memory loss and dementia. Rob Backlund is a member of the Leadership Board of Alzheimer's Association's Vermont chapter, and he spent time caring for his mother who lives in Michigan and has the disease. Rob, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm extremely grateful and humbled to have this opportunity.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about your mother and your relationship with her and what it's been like to learn she has this diagnosis and to take care of her.
My mother, Susan Backlund, was diagnosed around 2010. At that point, she was in her late 50s. She had just retired from being a special education teacher. At that moment in time, I was living out west in the mountains, and I felt definitely removed from the reality that our family was facing, my mom, my dad, and myself. I'm an only child. And at first it was, I didn't quite know how to react or even engage with the disease, with my mom's sort of cognitive decline, how I could help and support my father. And sort of as the past 7 years has progressed and the disease has progressed for my mother, started to find the bandwidth, the courage. I've had a flexible schedule being an outdoor educator and a high school science teacher to come home in the summers or take vacation during the holidays to get home and try to help. So unlike Sheila, I wasn't with my mom 24/7, 365. I would say I was a caregiver for my dad, and tried to do my best at distance. And at the end of 2015, I moved in with my parents because it just became too difficult for my dad on a daily basis to care for my mom. And even the two of us, we really, really struggled. And so she's in the late stages of the disease right now. She's in a memory care facility in northern Michigan.
When you first got that diagnosis, or your mom did and the whole family did, you say that it was a struggle to figure out how to connect with your parents and how to connect with the disease. Today, you've come in, you're wearing a shirt that says "The End of Alzheimer's Starts With Me." You're wearing a pin, which I assume is a picture of your mom and your dad together.
It is.
So you seem very connected. You've found a way not just to be connected to your mom and your dad, but to find a path to advocacy. Does that help you get through this personal situation by making it bigger than just your family?
It really has. And sort of the past 3 years, and Sheila mentioned this, for the first handful of years, I don't know if I could find the bandwidth or the courage to go to some type of therapy. And when I did, I was just blown away at how much it grounded me and helped. And once I was able to get to that spot and sort of just be okay with where we were and what we were going through as a family, that then I started to realize that I could advocate and that I could have a voice for my family, a voice that says that this disease needs to be acknowledged and needs to sort of be center in front. And and it's empowered me in dealing with losing my mother. It's empowered our family greatly to advocate and to sort of wear the badge that we're a family that has Alzheimer's, and we're not going to hide away anymore, and that we're going to stand up and say that the status quo of no prevention, no treatment, and no cure is just not acceptable in 2017.
Sheila, I see you nodding. Is that something you obviously would agree with? Do you find advocacy is a part of your life as well?
Totally, totally. We need to speak. We need to be a voice. We need to stand together. And we can't be forgotten about.
Yeah.
Don't forget us.
Did you find that, Sheila? I mean, one of the things that we've talked about before is how often when somebody is sick or suffers from an injury, friends kind of drop out, either because they don't know how to deal with it or they don't know how to help, or because you as the caregiver or as the person are not in those spaces where you used to connect. Is that something you found in your life, that there any isolation or sort of loss of friendships?
We did get very isolated for a while. Towards the end, we got very isolated because people didn't know how to relate to Jim or to me, because I was constantly exhausted. I didn't know how. I had no energy to put out. I couldn't even reach out for help at the end. Jim was home until 1 month before he went into a facility. And then he went into the veterans home in Bennington for 1 month, and then he passed away.
So you were really with him as full-time caregiver right up to the end.
I was.
And was it all-encompassing towards the end?
It was. I mean, there was the bathing and the food and the dressing and everything. It was everything.
What would you say to people who know someone like you
and don't know how to reach out or be helpful. Because, you know, it's a struggle, I think, for many people to try to figure out how do I be helpful and not be intrusive or not be offensive? I don't even know what to ask. You know, how would you say they should behave and help?
Call them and say, hey, how you doing? They don't have to volunteer to come over. Just say, hey, you know, I'm here. If you need anything, you know, just be a voice to them. You know, sometimes you get lost. I mean, I got lost in caring for Jim, that all I was doing was basically getting him up in the morning and dressed and sitting in the living room and food and medical appointments and, you know, the whole care and making sure he was safe. And in the very end, he started becoming a little agitated. And that's an important thing, too, I think, for people to understand is when do you make a decision that you can't do it anymore? And my decision came when Jim started going out the door and pushing me aside. And he was a big guy. You know, he was 6'1". And, you know, I couldn't stop him. You know, and it was December, January, you know, 10 degrees out. Safety. And he didn't understand. All he wanted to do was go home.
Where was home in his mind?
Home was, I asked him that. And home in his mind was a place where he felt safe. And he knew, he said, I don't want to be burdening you anymore. And he knew when he was lucid that it was very difficult for me. How hard it was to have to bathe him several times a day and just to do all the care for him. He knew it was very hard, and he wanted to go home where he could be safe. And when we found the veterans' home and they accepted him, he said, okay, that's my home.
Hmm.
I mean, he knew he was from Long Island, but he said they're not there anymore, meaning his parents. And he knew that he couldn't go there, but he wanted to go to a place where he could be taken care of and that it wasn't hard for me, that I could be his wife again.
Yeah.
He said, I want my wife back.
Did you get to be his wife for that last month?
I did.
Rob, we actually got a note from a listener named Charlene who says, when it's time for the person with Alzheimer's to move to assisted living, how do you go about moving them, especially when they're refusing to go? How did your family make that decision, and how do you help perhaps a person who feels that resistance?
If you've met one person with Alzheimer's, you've met one person with Alzheimer's, and I would say you could say that for the families too. If you've met one family that's affected by Alzheimer's, you've met one family. So there's different dynamics.
There are no universals.
Yeah, there's no universals. I think what's really important is that, you know, you start with a plan and not a promise early on, and that to not make promises of certain types of care, where they're going to be, but to create sort of a plan. And my dad and I, you know, and with the help of my mom's sisters, realized that it was just becoming too much for my dad, and that we couldn't provide promises. We had to have a plan. And at that point, when we did move my mom, my parents were living in Florida at the time, to her memory care facility in northern Michigan. She didn't even really know what was going on. She just honestly did not know. In a certain sense for us, that part was really easy. That first night walking out the door, I'll never forget. So I think it's really important, if along this journey of Alzheimer's or dementia, if you can create a plan in thinking about a care plan or a financial plan or a legal plan, and not promises, when you're really tired and it's been a number of years, and you're at wit's end and they're at wit's end, that you go to the plan and you don't feel like you're breaking promises that you no longer can keep.
What did it feel like that night when you walked out?
Probably one of the hardest nights of my life.
But it was the right decision?
But it was the right decision.
We're talking with Sheila Dooley and Rob Backlund. You guys are making me emotional today. It's really powerful to hear people's personal stories because, as you said, Rob, If you know someone, you know one family. On the other hand, if you know someone, a disease is personal. If you know a family, then you have an understanding of what it's like to go through this. Today, we're getting some perspective on what it's like to care for and love someone after a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or dementia. Caring for anyone, again, with a degenerative disease has so many challenges, but we're focusing on these illnesses that come along with memory loss and some very specific symptoms that often make caregiving very difficult. We're talking today with Rob Backlund and Sheila Dooley about their experiences, what they've learned. Sheila's husband, Jim, died earlier this year, and Rob's mother is living now in an assisted memory care living environment in Michigan. And let's go to Linda, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Linda. Go right ahead.
I'm good. Hi.
Hi.
I'm just calling in because I spent last year being a caregiver for my wife who was dying. And although she did not have dementia per se for the last 6 months of her life, she did. And I think I can, although it wasn't the amount of time some people are talking about here, I certainly can relate to the emotional and financial stress experience of trying to be a sole caregiver for someone and still maintain a full-time job, which was what was paying for the insurance. So I think my pitch today, I guess, is for Vermont to really needs family medical leave insurance. That I think would help so much with people like me who live a nice middle class life, you know, have an employer who's understanding that you go through your savings, you go through your time off, you go through everything, and there's really, as people have said, there's nobody else to take care of the person that you love. And I was lucky enough to be able to keep her at home until she died. But it was, as people have said, a pretty great financial and emotional cost. So I just wanted to put my two cents in for some sort of family medical leave. It's high time, and it would help so many people who are in the boat that I was in last year and the people who were calling in. So that's really all I had to say.
Linda, I really appreciate you sharing your perspective and sharing your thoughts on what it was like to care for your wife. I'm very sorry to hear about the death of your wife. And again, I really appreciate it. Let's go to Elaine calling in from Saxons River. Hi, Elaine. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. So I wanted to just alert people to a book that I have just published. It's called Take Care, Tales, Tips, and Love from Women Caregivers. And it's an anthology of poetry and prose written by 21 women caregivers. I will be reading around the state. I also wanted to just put in a pitch for women who are the primary caregivers. And just to give you one statistic that I think is really revealing is that an estimated 15.5 million caregivers provide over 17 billion hours of unpaid care for aging family members just with dementia in the year 2013. And so the value of women's unpaid work in caregiving is estimated to be between $150 and $190 billion annually. And as all your callers have said and your guests have said, their stories are just typical. So we should be mindful that it's mainly women, mainly daughters, who are the caregivers. And just also wanted to give a shout out to home care workers who are in the paid sector, because they provide, there are about 2 million of them, and that's not even enough. And they provide a huge number amount of caregiving in the home. And if the new healthcare legislation were to go through and Medicaid was to be cut, then those jobs would go, and so would the caretaking. So I really can't imagine how care would be provided to the growing number of people with dementia or with other illnesses who need care.
Elaine, thank you so much for mentioning those. I appreciate it. Again, Elaine Clifton, her book is called Take Care, Tales, Tips, and Love from Women Caregivers. You mentioned really important stats and important thoughts there. And it's a good time now to turn to Pamela Beidler, who's the Programs and Outreach Director for the Alzheimer's Association Vermont chapter. Pamela, nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So you've been hearing Sheila and Rob talk a little bit about their personal experiences. Does it resonate for you?
Absolutely. I think, as Elaine just said, these stories, unfortunately, are typical. This is definitely what we're hearing more and more from families.
So how does the Alzheimer's Association help?
Yeah, so the Alzheimer's Association really... We like to describe ourselves, particularly the Vermont chapter, like the state of Vermont. We are small, but we are mighty. There's only five of us that work in our office, but we cover the entire state. And we offer support to families and those living with Alzheimer's disease or another related form of dementia, with everything from help planning those initial visits with their provider to get a diagnosis up through long-term care planning. So everything from education to support groups and advocacy efforts, which Rob has been really instrumental in at the state and federal level.
We actually got a note from Tracy in Jericho, and I'll read more of her email in just a moment. But she did want to know, do you help with all forms of dementia? And it sounds like, yes, it's not just Alzheimer's.
Absolutely, we do. So there are a number of constituents that we work with Lewy bodies, Parkinson's with dementia, vascular dementia, all types.
So one of the things that I understand has recently started up is you actually have a telephone support group now. We were talking with Sheila about how isolating it can be, and it can be difficult in any stage of life to find the time to go to a support group. So how does the telephone support group work?
Absolutely. So this first came about because we recognize that Vermont is a rural state, and it can be difficult to travel to a support group. In addition, it can be hard to leave that loved one with dementia at home or find a care provider to come in so that you can then travel to the support group. Also, we live in Vermont, so the weather can pose a challenge. So we recognize that there was a need for this. So for the telephone support group, we have a confidential line that caregivers can call into. Right now, it's taking place once a month, and we have participants from all across the state who are able to call in. What's really nice about this, too, is I know that in small towns, there can be a concern about privacy, neighbors knowing neighbors. And so some of those more rural support groups, they have difficulty with attendance. So this, there's a little bit more privacy, and callers can still get that support and still connect with their peers and strategize around ways to support their loved one.
Pamela, I want to get back to Rob and Sheila's stories and what they've learned. But before I let you go, I know another thing that Sheila has mentioned, and actually Rob has mentioned too, was the importance of getting some support for themselves. And I know for you that that's something that you really want to emphasize, that don't wait until you're so exhausted and demoralized that you really are in a bad place, but reach out early, right?
Absolutely. So we know that it takes a village to care for somebody with Alzheimer's or another dementia. And there was recently a national survey that the Alzheimer's Association conducted that really looked at family dynamics and Alzheimer's. And overwhelmingly, about 91% said that they need more support. It takes a family. It takes a whole group to care for that person. But as Sheila said, you know, it can feel so isolating, and it can be hard for friends and family to know quite what to do. So in addition to those caregiving responsibilities and respite, I think that many caregivers are simply looking for opportunities to connect with those friends and peers outside of support groups, step outside of those caregiving responsibilities, and just have room for a little bit of fun in their lives too. But as you said, we want to hear from people at the earliest onset of this disease, potentially even before they go and get a diagnosis. But what we still see all too often is people are turning to us in crisis when they're desperate for services and connection. But we want to join them in those efforts at the very onset so we can plan ahead. It's all about being proactive instead of reactive in a crisis.
Pamela Beidler is the Programs and Outreach Director for the Alzheimer's Association's Vermont chapter. Pamela, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. And thank you, Rob and Sheila, for sharing your stories.
We are talking with Rob Backlund and Sheila Dooley about what it's been like for them. And, you know, we've heard now, I think, from all three of you. Sheila, you were telling us even in 2015 the importance of planning ahead. You were anticipating that Jim, because of a family history, might get Alzheimer's, that he had this he could be prone to it. Rob, you said for one of the biggest tips, biggest takeaways for you is plan before you hit that crisis, because then when you're in it, you already have a roadmap and you've already talked with your loved one, your mom in this case, about you know, what's going to happen, or your dad, who's really under the stress of primary caregiving in many ways. We got a note from Tracy in Jericho who says, I'm in Kentucky spending a week caring for my 80-plus-year-old mother, who after 5 years of attempts was diagnosed with frontotemporal dementia. For over 5 years, we, her children, have experienced disturbing behavioral changes, yet her friends would affirm her with words of encouragement, you're just tired, we all get a little cranky, or you showed them. When behaviors worsened and a move into an assisted living facility was indicated, her friends were most unhelpful. Now, Tracy, as I said, wanted to know if the Alzheimer's Association of Vermont helped with other forms of dementia, and they do. But she also says, do you have suggestions on balancing, explaining the full extent of the situation with your loved one's friends versus protecting, in this case, her mother's privacy? Rob, do you have thoughts for Tracy?
My father and I were definitely sort of reserved. I think people sort of knew that cognitively something was going on with my mother, Susan. But until sort of we had that diagnosis, even we were a little bit shy about it. And for me, it took years before I think I really was able to openly share to other folks. And it wasn't a factor of, I think, maybe privacy for my mom, but just being able to openly talk about it, I think, can be really, really challenging. Now it's something that, I sort of, like I said, wear as a badge. But I think for some folks, it might be really easy to just share. And I think, but also to respect that the person, that individual with a disease, maybe ask them. I'll be honest, I never directly spoke and have spoken with my mother about Alzheimer's. Made the decision that that wasn't going to necessarily be productive for us. Whether that's right or wrong, it's what we did. So I think it sort of boils down to the individual people involved in that situation.
Sheila, Jim died earlier this year. You talked about losing yourself towards the end because there was so much caregiving. What about now? Jim's gone, but you're still here. How are you finding a new sort of sense of self?
There is life after Alzheimer's. And it took me a while to grieve. You start grieving a long time ago. There's heavy grieving when the end is here. But again, there is life after Alzheimer's. I'm in a new relationship with John, and he's wonderful and supportive to me. And I just feel that you just move on. I don't forget about Jim, but you just move on. You move, you have to live. You can't just stop. And you continue to educate people about the disease. That's what I want to do. And I feel that I have gained a lot of knowledge in the journey that I have been on with Jim. I have a better understanding of Alzheimer's and dementia. I have a better understanding of caregiving and the role that I played. And I think I can help people understand some of the little hardships that you have to endure while you're doing it.
Well, Sheila, I really appreciate you coming back and talking with us. Sheila Dooley lives in Fairfax. Thanks for talking about Jim as well.
Thank you.
Rob Backlund lives in Burlington and is a member of the Vermont Alzheimer's Association Leadership Board. And Rob, I know for you, part of the importance of this is thinking about your own life and taking control and really working to prevent and cure Alzheimer's, because this obviously affects the next generation, which is you. And maybe we can talk with you sometime about that work that you're doing. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. Very grateful.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari, in for Jane Lindholm. Now we want to focus on the need for caring for those caregivers. This is a particular concern for Dr. Michael Lamantia. Dr. Lamantia is a geriatrician and director of the Center on Aging at UVM, and he recently sat down with Jane Lindholm to discuss this topic.
If we back up and look at how much caregivers for people with dementia are actually contributing to the economy in this sort of unpaid way and how much work is being done. Do you have a sense of just how much these people who are doing really difficult work are actually helping our economy work?
There are some dramatic figures out there around this. It's this question of who are the caregivers and what's the volume of work that they're doing. About one in three caregivers is age 65 or older. So these are people who also have their own medical issues that they're dealing. Approximately two-thirds of these caregivers are women. Specifically, over one-third of dementia caregivers are daughters. So if you think about that, there's a disparity in who is doing the majority of this work.
And just to be clear, is there a gender disparity in who gets the disease, or is that divided pretty evenly?
If you take a look at what the largest risk factor is for the development of dementia, it's age. And there's a disparity in this country in who lives to the oldest age, and that women live on average longer than men. So that's a factor that we have.
So more women have Alzheimer's, but that's a factor of age more than gender.
As I understand it, yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the scope of the problem when it comes to dementia? And often people think specifically of Alzheimer's disease here in Vermont.
Alzheimer's disease is a type of dementia, and there are other dementias besides Alzheimer's disease. The numbers, when you look at them, are striking because we see that there are currently 12 or 13,000 people who are affected by the disease in this state, and those numbers are projected to increase in the coming decade to about 17,000 by the year 2025.
With all kinds of dementia or specifically Alzheimer's?
When you take a look at Alzheimer's dementia. So 17,000 people doesn't potentially sound like a lot of people, but then you have to look at what is the population size of our state of Vermont. We're little Vermont, right? 600,000 people in our state. And if you take a moment and you ask yourself, how many people does it take to take care of one person with Alzheimer's disease when they're living at home in the community? It's 2 to 3 people. 2 to 3 times 17,000 gets you very quickly up to the number of almost 50,000. 50,000 into 600 means that 1 in 12 people in the coming decade are going to be involved in one way or another as being a caregiver for someone with dementia. So this is really something that's going to be affecting a lot of us. And yet we don't often talk about it. But this disease can be quite isolating for the person who's affected by it as well as the caregiver.
What are the things that you think people should know who may be entering this world that you're talking about in the next 10 years of being a caregiver to someone with Alzheimer's or other kinds of dementia?
Different medical practices approach this disease differently. In our clinics, we try and approach the patient and the caregiver as being a unit, and we're very explicit about that up front. And I try and reinforce messages of caregiver support and trying to warn caregivers about the ways that they can burn out over time if they don't take time to take care of themselves. Because if you make yourself a martyr to the cause and you burn the candle on both ends, eventually your health is going to suffer and you won't be able to take care of the person who you love and are caring for. So I try and emphasize to the caregivers that it's important that you get to your own doctor first to stay on top of your own medical issues. The second thing that I tell people is make sure that you take time away from caregiving. When you talk with caregivers, you find that this job is all-encompassing, and there are some caregivers out there who are trying to do this and work their regular job too, and you need to take at least 8 hours off a week to do something different than caregiving. I tell people that it's really important to participate in support groups. Support groups are fantastic because you get to connect with other people who are experiencing the same issues and may be able to talk with you about things in ways that your doctor can't. And then I tell them also about one free resource that's available out there that I think everyone who's affected by this disease should connect with, and that's www.alz.org, the Alzheimer's Association's website, which has lots of free information up there and lots of information about all these questions that you couldn't even imagine to ask at the beginning because you're so overwhelmed by just dealing with this diagnosis and what it's going to mean for yourself. And then, of course, when you have them back into the clinic, you want to make sure that you ask them all the time, how are you doing? So that's the one thing that we always risk not doing. We see the person there who's affected by the disease, the patient. And we say, how is he doing? How is she doing? But if we're doing our job correctly, we really should be slowing down and saying, how are you doing? Tell me about yourself. Tell me about what's going good. What do you find troubling for you? And that experience can be incredibly validating for a caregiver to know that they're being listened to.
What if you don't have a good support network, or you don't have a lot of money? You know, if you don't have the ability to either pay for care or a support network of other people who can come in and offer you some respite care, how do you get those 8 hours? I mean, even if you get a prescription from the doctor who says, go do some yoga or go for a walk or go have a beer with a friend, you may not feel like you can do that.
This is a difficult piece, and there's no one-size-fits-all answer for every single person out there. But we do know of resources in our community. Usually there are area agencies on aging, or in Vermont we have community health teams that have social workers that are available to clinics all around the state. And these dedicated professionals can usually work with someone one-on-one and try and figure out some combination of resources that are available in the community that might make it possible to go ahead and find that time away. Sometimes it's adult day programs, and there are adult day programs that are set up for persons with dementia. Sometimes it's finding a neighbor or a church group that happens to run a group and they have some type of respite care attached to it. When we're dealing with this disease, we try and be positive and look for solutions wherever we can, and remember that everything has to be tailored to the individual.
How do you talk about some of the psychological impacts that someone who's a caregiver might have as a disease progresses in someone they love? And I'm thinking specifically of things like arguments that sometimes a patient who has dementia has, or in the later stages of the disease when your loved one might not recognize you, might not know who you are.
Yes, it's very difficult when caregivers find themselves in those situations. I want to take a step back for a moment.
Yeah.
Caregivers sometimes find this experience of caregiving incredibly
wonderful
and mm-hmm. a positive experience, and something that is validating for them and allows them to give back to their loved one. So I want to just be careful to make sure that we acknowledge the fact that there are sometimes where caregivers think that this is one of the best things that they can do for somebody towards the end of their loved one's life. That said, there are these negative aspects of caregiving that can come up, particularly as each person runs their own race with this disease. And I try and connect with caregivers about sort of the do's and don'ts, or what we can say generally works for most people around this. So we have to realize that the person who is affected by dementia is living within their own world, and reasoning with them is not going to work. So sometimes you have to bite your lower lip and not go ahead and respond and seek the easiest way out of the confrontation that you're having. And that can be hard, but ultimately it avoids you burning the candle on both ends. You have to just sort of grin and understand what your priorities are. Your priorities usually are keeping the person safe, making sure that they know that they're loved, and understanding that you're not going to win every battle. It's about running the marathon rather than, you know, winning every sprint.
How often do you find that caregivers are experiencing some form of burnout?
Oh, very, very frequently. It's to be expected
yeah.
that they're going to feel burned out at one point or another. And so it's something that I ask people about very routinely. The reality is that we all don't get out of this alive anyway.
Right.
That's a piece of perspective that sometimes helps me as a doctor, as I deal with families who are doing this day after day, you know, 365 days a year, sometimes for years on end. But I try and normalize for my families that we're going to talk about these things when you come into the clinic. And I want to see them every few months to check on how they're doing.
The families too, not just the patient.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. I expect that when my patient comes to the clinic that I'm going to have their loved one in the room with me, and I'm going to talk with them and ask them how it's going. I want to see them as a pair. And there are plenty of times when I talk with my families with the person with the disease who is not in the room, so that they can talk with me about what's going on. Or they'll say to me, Dr. Lamanti, can I talk with you after the clinic visit at some point? And sometimes it happens naturally that there's 5-10 minutes afterwards. Sometimes it happens that I call them the next day and I talk with them about what's really going on, or things that they feel like they couldn't tell me right in front of mom or dad.
Well, Dr. Lamanti, I appreciate you telling us a little bit about what people who are caring for those with Alzheimer's and caring for people who care for those with Alzheimer's and other dementias should be thinking about. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
That's Dr. Michael Lamantia, a geriatrician and director of the Center on Aging at UVM.